Chapter 4, Pirates. If piracy means using the creative property of others without their permission, if, quote, if value then right, unquote, is true, then the history of the content industry is a history of piracy. Every important sector of big media today, film, records, radio, and cable TV, was born of a kind of piracy so defined. The consistent story is how last generation's pirates joined this generation's country club. Until now. Subheading is film. The film industry of Hollywood was built by fleeing pirates. Footnote 1. Creators and directors migrated from the East Coast to California in the early 20th century, in part to escape controls that patents granted the inventor of filmmaking, Thomas Edison. These controls were exercised through a monopoly, quote, trust, unquote, the Motion Pictures Patents Company, and were based on Thomas Edison's creative property patents. Edison formed the MPPC to exercise the rights this creative property gave him, and the MPPC was serious about the control it demanded. As one commentator tells one part of the story, quote, a January 1909 deadline was set for all companies to comply with the license. By February, unlicensed outlaws who referred to themselves as independents protested the trust and carried on business without submitting to the Edison monopoly. In the summer of 1909, the independent movement was in full swing, with producers and theater owners using illegal equipment and imported film stock to create their own underground market. With the country experiencing a tremendous expansion in the number of Nickelodeons, the Patents Company reacted to the independent movement by forming a strong-arm subsidiary known as the General Film Company to block the entry of non-licensed independents. With coercive tactics that have become legendary, General Film confiscated unlicensed equipment, discontinued product supply to theaters which showed unlicensed films, and effectively monopolized distribution with the acquisition of all U.S. film exchanges except for the one owned by the independent William Fox, who defied the trust even after his license was revoked. Close quote. Footnote 2. The Napsters of those days, the independents, were companies like Fox. And no less than today, these independents were vigorously resisted. Quote, shooting was disrupted by machinery stolen and, quote, accidents, resulting in loss of negatives, equipment, buildings, and sometimes life and limb frequently occurred. Close quote. Footnote 3. That led the independents to flee the East Coast. California was remote enough from Edison's reach that filmmakers there could pirate his inventions without fear of the law. And the leaders of Hollywood filmmaking, Fox most prominently, did just that. Of course, California grew quickly, and the effective enforcement of federal law eventually spread west. But because patents grant the patent holder a truly limited monopoly, just 17 years at that time, by the time enough federal marshals appeared, the patents had expired. A new industry had been born, in part from the piracy of Edison's creative property. Subheading recorded music. The record industry was born of another kind of piracy, though to see how requires a bit of detail about the way the law regulates music. At the time that Edison and Henri Fourneau invented machines for reproducing music, Edison the phonograph, Fourneau the player piano, the law gave composers the exclusive right to control copies of their music, and the exclusive right to control public performances of their music. In other words, in 1900, if I wanted a copy of Phil Russell's 1899 hit Happy Mosey, the law said I would have to pay for the right to get a copy of the musical score, and I would also have to pay for the right to perform it publicly. But what if I wanted to record Happy Mosey using Edison's phonograph or Fourneau's player piano? Here, the law stumbled. It was clear enough that I would have to buy any copy of the musical score that I performed in making this recording, and it was clear enough that I would have to pay for any public performance of the work I was recording. But it wasn't totally clear that I would have to pay for a public performance if I recorded the song in my own house, Even today, you don't owe the Beatles anything if you sing their songs in the shower. Or if I recorded the song from memory. Copies in your brain are not yet regulated by copyright law. So if I simply sang the song into a recording device in the privacy of my own home, it wasn't clear that I owed the composer anything. And more importantly, it wasn't clear whether I owed the composer anything if I then made copies of those recordings. Because of this gap in the law, then, I could effectively pirate someone else's song without paying its composer anything. The composers and publishers were none too happy about this capacity to pirate. As South Dakota Senator Alfred Kittredge put it, quote, "Imagine the injustice of the thing. A composer writes a song or an opera. A publisher buys, at great expense, the rights to the same and copyrights it. Along comes the phonographic companies and companies who cut music rolls and deliberately steal the work of the brain of the composer and publisher without any regard for their rights." Close quote. Footnote 4. The innovators who developed the technology to record other people's works were, quote, "sponging upon the toil, the work, the talent, the genius of American composers," close quote, footnote 5. And the music publishing industry was thereby, quote, "at the complete mercy of this one pirate," close quote, footnote 6. As John Philip Sousa put it in as direct a way as possible, quote, "when they make money out of my pieces, I want a share of it," close quote. Footnote 7. These arguments have familiar echoes in the wars of our day. So too do the arguments on the other side. The innovators who developed the player piano argued that, quote, "it is perfectly demonstrable that the introduction of automatic music players has not deprived any composer of anything he had before their introduction," close quote. Rather, the machines increase the sales of sheet music, footnote 8. In any case, the innovators argued the job of Congress was, quote, "to consider first the interest of the public whom they represent and whose servants they are. All talk about theft," the general counsel of the American Gramophone Company wrote, "is the merest claptrap, for there exists no property in ideas, musical, literary, or artistic, except as defined by statute," footnote 9. The law soon resolved this battle in favor of the composer and the recording artist. Congress amended the law to make sure that composers would be paid for the mechanical reproductions of their music. But rather than simply granting the composer complete control over the right to make mechanical reproductions, Congress gave recording artists a right to record the music at a price set by Congress, once the composer allowed it to be recorded once. This is the part of copyright law that makes cover songs possible. Once a composer authorizes a recording of a song, others are free to record the same song, so long as they pay the original composer a fee set by the law. American law ordinarily calls this a compulsory license, but I'll refer to it as a statutory license. A statutory license is a license whose key terms are set by law. After Congress's amendment of the Copyright Act in 1909, record companies were free to distribute copies of recordings so long as they paid the composer or copyright holder the fee set by the statute. This is an exception within the law of copyright. When John Grisham writes a novel, a publisher is free to publish that novel only if Grisham gives the publisher permission. Grisham, in turn, is free to charge whatever he wants for that permission. The price to publish Grisham is thus set by Grisham, and copyright law ordinarily says you have no permission to use Grisham's work except with permission of Grisham. But the law governing recordings gives recording artists less, and thus, in effect, the law subsidizes the recording industry through a kind of piracy, by giving recording artists a weaker right than it otherwise gives creative authors. The Beatles have less control over their creative work than Grisham does, and the beneficiaries of this less control are the recording industry and the public. The recording industry gets something of value for less than it otherwise would pay. The public gets access to a much wider range of musical creativity. Indeed, Congress was quite explicit about its reasons for granting this right, Its fear was the monopoly power of rights holders, and that that power would stifle follow-on creativity. Footnote 10. While the recording industry has been quite coy about this recently, historically it has been quite a supporter of the statutory license for records. As a 1967 report from the House Committee on the Judiciary relates, quote, the record producers argued vigorously that the compulsory license system must be retained. They asserted that the record industry is a $500 million business of great economic importance in the United States and throughout the world. Records today are the principal means of disseminating music, and this creates special problems since performers need unhampered access to musical material on non-discriminatory terms. Historically, the record producers pointed out there were no recording rights before 1909, and the 1909 statute adopted the compulsory license as a deliberate anti-monopoly condition on the grant of these rights. They argue that the result has been an outpouring of recorded music, with the public being given lower prices, improved quality, and a greater choice. Footnote 11. By limiting the rights musicians have, by partially pirating their creative work, the record producers and the public benefit. Next subheading is radio. Radio was also born of piracy. When a radio station plays a record on the air that constitutes a public performance of the composer's work, footnote 12, as I described above, the law gives the composer or copyright holder an exclusive right to public performances of his work. The radio station thus owes the composer money for that performance. But when the radio station plays a record, it is not only performing a copy of the composer's work, the radio station is also performing a copy of the recording artist's work. It's one thing to have Happy Birthday sung on the radio by the local children's choir. It's quite another to have it sung by the Rolling Stones or Lyle Lovett. The recording artist is adding to the value of the composition performed on the radio station. And if the law were perfectly consistent, the radio station would have to pay the recording artist for his work, just as it pays the composer of the music for his work. But it doesn't. Under the law governing radio performances, the radio station does not have to pay the recording artist. The radio station need only pay the composer. The radio station thus gets a bit of something for nothing. It gets to perform the recording artist's work for free, even if it must pay the composer something for the privilege of playing the song. This difference can be huge. Imagine you compose a piece of music. Imagine it is your first. You own the exclusive right to authorize public performances of that music. So if Madonna wants to sing your song in public, she has to get your permission. Imagine she does sing your song, and imagine she likes it a lot. She then decides to make a recording of your song and it becomes a top hit. Under our law, every time a radio station plays your song, you get some money. But Madonna gets nothing, save the indirect effect on the sale of her CDs. The public performance of her recording is not a protected right. The radio station thus gets to pirate the value of Madonna's work without paying her anything. No doubt one might argue that on balance the recording artists benefit. On average, the promotion they get is worth more than the performance rights they give up, maybe. But even if so, the law ordinarily gives the creator the right to make this choice. By making the choice for him or her, the law gives the radio station the right to take something for nothing. The next subheading is cable TV. Cable TV was also born of a kind of piracy. When cable entrepreneurs first started wiring communities with cable television in 1948, most refused to pay broadcasters for the content that they echoed to their customers. Even when the cable companies started selling access to television broadcasts, they refused to pay for what they sold. Cable companies were thus Napsterizing broadcasters' content, but more egregiously than anything Napster ever did. Napster never charged for the content it enabled others to give away. Broadcasters and copyright owners were quick to attack this theft. Russell Hyde, chairman of the FCC, viewed the practice as a kind of, quote, unfair and potentially destructive competition, close quote. Footnote 13. There may have been a public interest in spreading the reach of cable TV, but as Douglas Anello, general counsel to the National Association of Broadcasters, asked Senator Quentin Burdick during testimony, does public interest dictate that you use somebody else's property? Footnote 14. As another broadcaster put it, quote, the extraordinary thing about the CATV business is that it is the only business I know of where the product that is being sold is not paid for. Footnote 15. Again, the demand of the copyright holder seemed reasonable enough. Quote, all we are asking for is a very simple thing, that people who now take our property for nothing pay for it. We're trying to stop piracy, and I don't think there is any lesser word to describe it. I think there are harsher words which would fit it. Footnote 16. These were free riders, Screen Actors Guild President Charlton Heston said, who were, quote, depriving actors of compensation, close quote. Footnote 17. But again, there was another side to the debate. As Assistant Attorney General Edwin Zimmerman put it, quote, our point here is that unlike the problem of whether you have any copyright protection at all, the problem here is whether copyright holders who are already compensated, who already have a monopoly, should be permitted to extend that monopoly. The question here is how much compensation they should have and how far back they should carry their right to compensation. Footnote 18. Copyright owners took the cable companies to court. Twice, the Supreme Court held that the cable companies owed the copyright owners nothing. It took Congress almost 30 years before it resolved the question of whether cable companies had to pay for the content they, quote, pirated. In the end, Congress resolved this question the same way it resolved the question about record players and player pianos. Yes, cable companies would have to pay for the content that they broadcast, but the price they would have to pay was not set by the copyright owner. The price was set by law, so that the broadcasters couldn't exercise veto power over the emerging technologies of cable. Cable companies thus built their empire in part upon a piracy of the value created by broadcasters' content. These separate stories sing a common theme. If piracy means using value from someone else's creative property without permission from that creator, as it is increasingly described today, footnote 19, then every industry affected by copyright today is the product and beneficiary of a certain kind of piracy. Film, records, radio, cable TV, the list is long and could well be expanded. Every generation welcomes the pirates from the last. Every generation until now. Chapter 5, Piracy. There is piracy of copyrighted material, lots of it. This piracy comes in many forms. The most significant is commercial piracy, the unauthorized taking of other people's content within a commercial context. Despite the many justifications that are offered in its defense, this taking is wrong. No one should condone it, and the law should stop it. But as well as copy shop piracy, there's another kind of taking that is more directly related to the internet. That taking too seems wrong to many, and it is wrong much of the time. Before we paint this taking piracy, however, we should understand its nature a bit more. For the harm of this taking is significantly more ambiguous than outright copying, and the law should account for that ambiguity, as it has so often done in the past. All across the world, but especially in Asia and Eastern Europe, there are businesses that do nothing but take other people's copyrighted content, copy it, and sell it, all without the permission of a copyright owner. The recording industry estimates that it loses about $4.6 billion every year to physical piracy. Footnote 1. That works out to 1 in 3 CDs sold worldwide. The MPAA estimates that it loses $3 billion annually worldwide to piracy. This is piracy, plain and simple. Nothing in the argument of this book, nor in the argument that most people make when talking about the subject of this book, should draw into doubt this simple point. This piracy is wrong. Which is not to say that excuses and justifications couldn't be made for it. We could, for example, remind ourselves that for the first 100 years of the American Republic, America did not honor foreign copyrights. We were born in this sense a pirate nation. It might therefore seem hypocritical for us to insist so strongly that other developing nations treat as wrong what we, for the first 100 years of our existence, treated as right. That excuse isn't terribly strong. Technically, our law did not ban the taking of foreign works. It explicitly limited itself to American works. Thus, the American publishers who published foreign works without the permission of foreign authors were not violating any rule. The copy shops in Asia, by contrast, are violating Asian law. Asian law does protect foreign copyrights, and the actions of the copy shops violate that law. So the wrong of piracy that they engage in is not just a moral wrong, but a legal wrong, and not just an internationally legal wrong, but a locally legal wrong as well. True, these local laws have in effect been imposed upon these countries. No country can be part of the world economy and choose not to protect copyright internationally. We may have been born a pirate nation, but we will not allow any other nation to have a similar childhood. If a country is to be treated as a sovereign, however, then its laws are its laws regardless of their source. The international law under which these nations live gives them some opportunities to escape the burden of intellectual property law. Footnote 2. In my view, more developing nations should take advantage of that opportunity, but when they don't, then their laws should be respected. And under the laws of these nations, this piracy is wrong. Alternatively, we could try to excuse this piracy by noting that in any case it does no harm to the industry. The Chinese who get access to American CDs at 50 cents a copy are not people who would have bought these American CDs at $15 a copy, so no one really has any less money than they otherwise would have had. Footnote 3. This is often true, though I have friends who have purchased many thousands of pirated DVDs who certainly have enough money to pay for the content they have taken. And it does mitigate, to some degree, the harm caused by such taking. Extremists in this debate love to say, you wouldn't go into Barnes & Noble and take a book off the shelf without paying. Why should it be any different with online music? The difference is, of course, that when you take a book from Barnes & Noble, it has one less book to sell. By contrast, when you take an MP3 from a computer network, there is not one less CD that can be sold. The physics of piracy of the intangible are different from the physics of piracy of the tangible. This argument is still very weak. However, although copyright is a property right of a very special sort, it is a property right. Like all property rights, the copyright gives the owner the right to decide the terms under which content is shared. If the copyright owner doesn't want to sell, she doesn't have to. There are exceptions. Important statutory licenses that apply to copyrighted content regardless of the wish of the copyright owner. Those licenses give people the right to take copyrighted content whether or not the copyright owner wants to sell. But where the law does not give people the right to take content, it is wrong to take that content, even if the wrong does no harm. If we have a property system and that system is properly balanced to the technology of the time, then it's wrong to take property without the permission of a property owner. That is exactly what property means. Finally, we could try to excuse this piracy with the argument that the piracy actually helps the copyright owner. When the Chinese, quote, steal, unquote, Windows, that makes the Chinese dependent on Microsoft. Microsoft loses the value of the software that was taken, but it gains users who are used to life in the Microsoft world. Over time, as the nation grows more wealthy, more and more people will buy software rather than steal it. And hence, over time, because that buying will benefit Microsoft, Microsoft benefits from the piracy. If instead of pirating Microsoft Windows, the Chinese used the free GNU Linux operating system, then those Chinese users would not eventually be buying Microsoft. Without piracy, then, Microsoft would lose. This argument, too, is somewhat true. The addiction strategy is a good one. Many businesses practice it. Some thrive because of it. Law students, for example, are given free access to the two largest legal databases. The companies marketing both hope the student will become so used to their service they'll want to use it and not the others when they become lawyers and must pay high subscription fees. Still, the argument is not terribly persuasive. We don't give the alcoholic a defense when he steals his first beer, merely because that will make it more likely he'll buy the next three. Instead, we ordinarily allow businesses to decide for themselves when it's best to give their product away. If Microsoft fears the competition of GNU Linux, then Microsoft can give its product away, as it did, for example, with Internet Explorer to fight Netscape. A property right means giving the property owner the right to say who gets access to what, at least ordinarily. And if the law properly balances the rights of the copyright owner with the rights of access, then violating the law is still wrong. Thus, while I understand the pull of these justifications for piracy, and I certainly see the motivation, in my view, in the end, these efforts at justifying commercial piracy simply don't cut it. This kind of piracy is rampant and just plain wrong. It doesn't transform the content it steals, it doesn't transform the market it competes in, it merely gives someone access to something that the law says he should not have. Nothing has changed to draw that law into doubt. This form of piracy is flat out wrong. But as the examples from the four chapters that introduce this part suggest, even if some piracy is plainly wrong, not all piracy is. Or at least, not all piracy is wrong if that term is understood in the way it is increasingly used today. Many kinds of piracy are useful and productive to produce either new content or new ways of doing business. Neither our tradition nor any tradition has ever banned all piracy in that sense of the term. This doesn't mean that there are no questions raised by the latest piracy concern, peer-to-peer file sharing, but it does mean that we need to understand the harm in peer-to-peer sharing a bit more before we condemn it to the gallows with the charge of piracy. For one, like the original Hollywood, P2P sharing escapes an overly controlling industry. And two, like the original recording industry, it simply exploits a new way to distribute content. But three, unlike cable TV, no one is selling the content that is shared on P2P services. These differences distinguish P2P sharing from true piracy. They should push us to find a way to protect artists while enabling the sharing to survive. Piracy 2 is the subheading. The key to the piracy that the law aims to quash is a use that, quote, robs the author of his profit, footnote 4. This means we must determine whether and how much P2P sharing harms before we know how strongly the law should seek to either prevent it or find an alternative to assure the author of his profit. Peer-to-peer sharing was made famous by Napster, but the inventors of the Napster technology had not made any major technological innovations. Like every great advance in innovation on the internet, and arguably off the internet as well, footnote 5, Sean Fanning and crew had simply put together components that had been developed independently. The result was spontaneous combustion. Launched in July 1999, Napster amassed over 10 million users within 9 months. After 18 months, there were close to 80 million registered users of the system, footnote 6. Courts quickly shut Napster down, but other services emerged to take its place. Kazaa is currently the most popular P2P service. It boasts over 100 million members. These services systems are different architecturally, though not very different in function. Each enables users to make content available to any number of other users. With a P2P system, you can share your favorite songs with your best friend or your 20,000 best friends. According to a number of estimates, a huge proportion of Americans have tasted file-sharing technology. A study by Ipsos Insight in September 2002 estimated that 60 million Americans had downloaded music, 28% of Americans older than 12. Footnote 7. A survey by the NPD Group quoted in the New York Times estimated that 43 million citizens used file-sharing networks to exchange content in May 2003, footnote 8. The vast majority of these are not kids. Whatever the actual figure, a massive quantity of content is being taken on these networks. The ease and inexpensiveness of file-sharing networks have inspired millions to enjoy music in a way that they hadn't before. Some of this enjoying involves copyright infringement. Some of it does not. And even among the part that is technically copyright infringement, calculating the actual harm to copyright owners is more complicated than one might think. So consider, a bit more carefully than the polarized voices around this debate usually do, the kinds of sharing that file sharing enables, and the kinds of harm it entails. File sharers share different kinds of content. We can divide these different kinds into four types. A, there are some who are, use sharing networks as substitutes for purchasing content. Thus, when a new Madonna CD is released, rather than buying the CD, these users simply take it. We might quibble about whether everyone who takes it would actually have bought it if sharing didn't make it available for free. Most probably wouldn't have, but clearly there are some who would. The latter are the target of Category A, users who download instead of purchasing. B, there are some who use sharing networks to sample music before purchasing it. Thus, a friend sends another friend an MP3 of an artist he's not heard of. The other friend then buys CDs by that artist. This is a kind of targeted advertising quite likely to succeed. If the friend recommending the album gains nothing from a bad recommendation, then one would expect that the recommendations will actually be quite good. The net effect of this sharing could increase the quantity of music purchased. C, there are many who use sharing networks to get access to copyrighted content that is no longer sold, or that they would not have purchased because the transaction costs off the net are too high. This use of sharing networks is among the most rewarding for many. Songs that were part of your childhood but have long vanished from the marketplace magically appear again on the network. One friend told me that when she discovered Napster, she spent a solid weekend recalling old songs. She was astonished at the range and mix of content that was available. For content not sold, this is still technically a violation of copyright, though because the copyright owner is not selling the content anymore, the economic harm is zero. The same harm that occurs when I sell my collection of 1960s 45 RPM records to a local collector. D. Finally, there are many who use sharing networks to get access to content that is not copyrighted or that the copyright owner wants to give away. How do these different types of sharing balance out? Let's start with some simple but important points. From the perspective of the law, only type D sharing is clearly legal. From the perspective of economics, only type A sharing is clearly harmful. Type B sharing is illegal but plainly beneficial. Type C sharing is illegal yet good for society, since more exposure to music is good, and harmless to the artist since the work is not otherwise available. So how sharing matters on balance is a hard question to answer, and certainly much more difficult than the current rhetoric around the issue suggests. Whether on balance sharing is harmful depends importantly on how harmful type A sharing is. Just as Edison complained about Hollywood, composers complained about piano rolls, recording artists complained about radio, and broadcasters complained about cable TV, the music industry complains that type A sharing is a kind of theft that is devastating the industry. While the numbers do suggest that sharing is harmful, how harmful is harder to reckon. It has long been the recording industry's practice to blame technology for any drop in sales. The history of cassette recording is a good example. As a study by Capgemini, Ernst & Young put it, quote, rather than exploiting this new popular technology, the labels fought it, footnote 10. The labels claimed that every album taped was an album unsold, and when record sales fell by 11.4% in 1981, the industry claimed that its point was proved. Technology was the problem, and banning or regulating technology was the answer. Yet, soon thereafter, and before Congress was given an opportunity to enact regulation, MTV was launched, and the industry had a record turnaround. In the end, Capgemini concludes, the crisis was not the fault of the tapers, who did not stop after MTV came into being, but had to a large extent resulted from stagnation in musical innovation at the major labels. Footnote 11. But just because the industry was wrong before does not mean it is wrong today. To evaluate the real threat that P2P sharing presents to the industry in particular and society in general, or at least the society that inherits the tradition that gave us the film industry, the record industry, the radio industry, cable TV, and the VCR, the question is not simply whether type A sharing is harmful. The question is also how harmful type A sharing is and how beneficial the other types of sharing are. We start to answer this question by focusing on the net harm from the standpoint of the industry as a whole that sharing networks cause. The net harm to the industry as a whole is the amount by which type A sharing exceeds type B. If the record companies sold more records through sampling than they lost through substitution, then sharing networks would actually benefit music companies on balance. They would therefore have little static reason to resist them. Could that be true? Could the industry as a whole be gaining because of file sharing? Odd as that might sound, the data about CD sales actually suggest it might be close. In 2002, the RIAA reported that CD sales had fallen by 8.9%, from 882 million to 803 million units. Revenues fell 6.7%, footnote 12. This confirms a trend over the past few years. The RIAA blames internet piracy for the trend, though there are many other causes that could account for this drop. SoundScan, for example, reports a more than 20% drop in the number of CDs released since 1999. That no doubt accounts for some of the decrease in sales. Rising prices could account for at least some of the loss. From 1999 to 2001, the average price of a CD rose 7.2%, from $13.04 to $14.19, footnote 13. Competition from other forms of media could also account for some of the decline. As Jane Black of Business Week notes, the soundtrack to the film High Fidelity has a list price of $18.98. You could get the whole movie on DVD for $19.99, footnote 14. But let's assume the RIAA is right and all of the decline in CD sales is because of internet sharing. Here's the rub. In the same period that the RIAA estimates that 803 million CDs were sold, the RIAA estimates that 2.1 billion CDs were downloaded for free. Thus, although 2.6 times the total number of CDs sold were downloaded for free, sales revenue fell by just 6.7%. There are too many different things happening at the same time to explain these numbers definitively, but one conclusion is unavoidable. The recording industry constantly asks, what's the difference between downloading a song and stealing a CD? But their own numbers reveal the difference. If I steal a CD, there is one less CD to sell. Every taking is a lost sale. But on the basis of the numbers the RIAA provides, it is absolutely clear that the same is not true of downloads. If every download were a lost sale, if every use of Kazaa robbed the author of his profit, then the industry would have suffered a 100% drop in sales last year, not a 7% drop. If 2.6 times the number of CDs sold were downloaded for free, and yet sales revenue dropped by just 6.7%, then there's a huge difference between downloading a song and stealing a CD. These are the harms, alleged and perhaps exaggerated, but let's assume real. What of the benefits? File sharing may impose costs on the recording industry. What value does it produce in addition to these costs? One benefit is Type C sharing, making available content that is technically still under copyright but is no longer commercially available. This is not a small category of content. There are millions of tracks that are no longer commercially available. Footnote 15. And while it's conceivable that some of this content is not available because the artist producing the content doesn't want it to be made available, the vast majority of it is unavailable solely because the publisher or the distributor has decided it no longer makes economic sense to the company to make it available. In real space, long before the internet, the market had a simple response to this problem: used book and record stores. There are thousands of used book and used record stores in America today. Footnote 16. These stores buy content from owners, then sell the content they buy. And under American copyright law, when they buy and sell this content, even if the content is still under copyright, the copyright owner doesn't get a dime. Used book and record stores are commercial entities. Their owners make money from the content they sell. But as with cable companies before statutory licensing, they don't have to pay the copyright owner for the content they sell. Type C sharing, then, is very much like used bookstores or used record stores. It's different, of course, because the person making the content available isn't making money from making the content available. It's also different, of course, because in real space, when I sell a record, I don't have it anymore. While in cyberspace, when someone shares my 1949 recording of Bernstein's Two Love Songs, I still have it. That difference would matter economically if the owner of the 1949 copyright were selling the record in competition to my sharing. But we're talking about the class of content that is not currently commercially available. The internet is making it available through cooperative sharing without competing with the market. It may well be, all things considered, that it would be better if the copyright owner got something from this trade. But just because it may well be better, it doesn't follow that it would be good to ban used bookstores. Or put differently, if you think that Type C sharing should be stopped, do you think that libraries and used used bookstores should be shut as well? Finally, and perhaps most importantly, file sharing networks enable Type D sharing to occur. The sharing of content that copyright owners want to have shared, or for which there is no continuing copyright. This sharing clearly benefits authors and society. Science fiction author Cory Doctorow, for example, released his first novel, Down and Out of the Magic Kingdom, both free online and in bookstores at the same time, the same day. His and his publisher's thinking was that the online distribution would be a great advertisement for the real book. People would read part online and then decide whether they liked the book or not. If they liked it, they would be more likely to buy it. Doctorow's content is Type D content. If sharing networks enable his works to be spread, then both he and society are better off. Actually, much better off. It is a great book. Likewise, for work in the public domain, this sharing benefits society with no legal harm to authors at all. If efforts to solve the problem of Type A sharing destroy the opportunity for Type D sharing, then we lose something important in order to protect Type A content. The point throughout is this: while the recording industry understandably says, "This is how much we've lost," we must also ask, how much has society gained from P2P sharing? What are the efficiencies? What is the content that otherwise would be unavailable? For unlike the piracy I described in the first sections of this chapter, much of the piracy that file sharing enables is plainly legal and good. And like the piracy I described in chapter 4, much of this piracy is motivated by a new way of spreading content caused by changes in the technology of distribution. Thus, consistent with the tradition that gave us Hollywood, radio, the recording industry, and cable TV, the question we should be asking about file sharing is how best to preserve its benefits while minimizing, to the extent possible, the wrongful harm it causes artists. The question is one of balance. The law should seek that balance, and that balance will be found only with time. But isn't the war just a war against illegal sharing Isn't the target just what you would call type A sharing? You would think, and we should hope, but so far it is not. The effect of the war purportedly on type A sharing alone has been felt far beyond that one class of sharing. That much is obvious from the Napster case itself. When Napster told the district court that it had developed a technology to block the transfer of 99.4% of identified infringing material, the district court told counsel for Napster 99.4% was not good enough. Napster had to push the infringements, quote, down to zero, footnote 17. If 99.4% is not good enough, then this is a war on file sharing technologies, not a war on copyright infringement. There's no way to ensure that a P2P system is used 100% of the time in compliance with the law, any more than there's any way to assure that 100% of VCRs or 100% of Xerox machines or 100% of handguns are used in compliance with the law. Zero tolerance means zero P2P. The court's ruling means that we as a society must lose the benefits of P2P, even for the totally legal and beneficial uses they serve, simply to assure that there are zero copyright infringements caused by P2P. Zero tolerance has not been our history. It has not produced the content industry that we know today. The history of American law has been a process of balance. As new technologies changed the way content was distributed, the law adjusted, after some time, to the new technology. In this adjustment, the law sought to ensure the legitimate rights of creators while protecting innovation. Sometimes this has meant more rights for creators, sometimes less. So as we've seen, when mechanical reproduction threatened the interest of composers, Congress balanced the rights of composers against the interests of the recording industry. It granted rights to composers, but also to the recording artists. Composers were to be paid, but at a price set by Congress. But when radio started broadcasting the recordings made by these recording artists, and they complained to Congress that their creative property was not being respected, since the radio station did not have to pay them for their creativity at broadcast, Congress rejected their claim. An indirect benefit was enough. Cable TV followed the pattern of record albums. When the courts rejected the claim that cable broadcasters had to pay for the content they rebroadcast, Congress responded by giving broadcasters a right to compensation, but at a level set by law. It likewise gave cable companies the right to the content so long as they paid the statutory price. This compromise, like the compromise affecting records and player pianos, served two important goals. First, the two central goals of any copyright legislation. First, the law assured that new innovators would have the freedom to develop new ways to deliver content. Second, the law assured that copyright holders would be paid for the content that was distributed. One fear was that if Congress simply required cable TV to pay copyright holders whatever they demanded for their content, then copyright holders associated with broadcasters would use their power to stifle this new technology cable. But if Congress had permitted cable to use broadcasters' contents for free, then it would have unfairly subsidized cable. Thus, Congress chose a path that would assure compensation without giving the past, broadcasters, control over the future, cable. In the same year that Congress struck this balance, two major producers and distributors of film content filed a lawsuit against another technology, the videotape recorder, VTR, or as we refer to them today, VCRs, that Sony had produced, the Betamax. Disney's and Universal's claim against Sony was relatively simple. Sony produced a device, Disney and Universal claimed, that enabled consumers to engage in copyright infringement. Because the device that Sony built had a record button, the device could be used to record copyrighted movies and shows. Sony was therefore benefiting from the copyright infringement of its customers. It should, therefore, Disney and Universal claimed, be partially liable for that infringement. There was something to Disney's and Universal's claim. Sony did decide to design its machine to make it very simple to record television shows. It could have built the machine to block or inhibit any direct copying from a television broadcast. Or possibly it could have built the machine to copy only if there were a special copy me signal on the line. It was clear that there were many television shows that did not grant anyone permission to copy. Indeed, if anyone had asked, no doubt the majority of shows would not have authorized copying. And in the face of this obvious preference, Sony could have designed its system to minimize the opportunity for copyright infringement. It did not, and for that, Disney and Universal wanted to hold it responsible for the architecture it chose. MPAA President Jack Valenti became the studio's most vocal champion. Valenti calls VCRs tapeworms. He warned, "When there are 20, 30, 40 million of these VCRs in the land, we will be invaded by millions of tapeworms, eating away at the very heart and essence of the most precious asset the copyright owner has, his copyright." Footnote 18. "One does not have to be trained in sophisticated marketing and creative judgment," he told Congress, "to understand the devastation on the after-theater marketplace caused by the hundreds of millions of tapings that will adversely impact on the future of the creative community in this country. It is simply a question of basic economics and plain common sense." Footnote 19. Indeed, as surveys would later show, 45% of VCR owners had movie libraries of 10 videos or more. Footnote 20. A use the court would later hold was not fair. By allowing VCR owners to copy freely by the means of an exemption from copyright infringement without creating a mechanism to compensate copyright owners, Valenti testified, Congress would take from the owners the very essence of their property, the exclusive right to control who may use their work, that is, who may copy it and thereby profit from its reproduction. Footnote 21. It took 8 years for this case to be resolved by the Supreme Court. In the interim, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which includes Hollywood in its jurisdiction, leading judge Alex Kaczynski, who sits on that court, refers to it as the Hollywood Circuit, held that Sony would be liable for the copyright infringement made possible by its machines. Under the Ninth Circuit's rule, this totally familiar technology, which Jack Valenti had called the Boston Strangler of the American film industry, worse yet, it was a Japanese Boston Strangler of the American film industry, was an illegal technology, footnote 22. But the Supreme Court reversed the decision of the Ninth Circuit. And in its reversal, the court clearly articulated its understanding of when and whether courts should intervene in such disputes. As the court wrote, "Sound policy, as well as history, supports our consistent deference to Congress when major technological innovations alter the market for copyrighted materials. Congress has the constitutional authority and the institutional ability to accommodate fully the varied permutations of competing interests that are inevitably implicated by such new technology." Footnote 23. Congress was asked to respond to the Supreme Court's decision. But as with the plea of recording artists about radio broadcasts, Congress ignored the request. Congress was convinced that American film got enough, this taking notwithstanding. If we put these cases together, a pattern is clear. In each case throughout our history, a new technology changed the way content was distributed, footnote 24. In each case throughout our history, that change meant that someone got a free ride on someone else's work. In none of these cases did either the courts or Congress eliminate all free writing. In none of these cases did the court or Congress insist that the law should assure that the copyright holder get all the value that is copyright created. In every case, the copyright owners complained of piracy. In every case, Congress acted to recognize some of the legitimacy in the behavior of the pirates. In each case, Congress allowed some new technology to benefit from content made before. It balanced the interests at stake. When you think across these examples and the other examples that make up the first four chapters of this section, this balance makes sense. Was Walt Disney a pirate? Would doujinshi be better if creators had to ask permission? Should tools that enables others to capture and spread images as a way to cultivate or criticize our culture be better regulated? Is it really right that building a search engine should expose you to $15 million in damages? Would it have been better if Edison had controlled film? Should every cover band have to hire a lawyer to get permission to record a song? We could answer yes to each of these questions, but our tradition has answered no. In our tradition, as the Supreme Court has stated, copyright, quote, has never accorded the copyright owner complete control over all possible uses of his work, footnote 25. Instead, the particular uses that the law regulates have been defined by balancing the good that comes from granting an exclusive right against the burdens such an exclusive right creates. And this balancing has historically been done after a technology has matured or settled into the mix of technologies that facilitate the distribution of content. We should be doing the same thing today. The technology of the internet is changing quickly. The way people connect to the internet, wires versus wireless, is changing very quickly. No doubt the network should not become a tool for stealing from artists, but neither should the law become a tool to entrench one particular way in which artists, or more accurately, distributors, get paid. As I describe in some detail in the last chapter of this book, we should be securing income to artists while we allow the market to secure the most efficient way to promote and distribute content. This will require changes in the law, at least in the interim. These changes should be designed to balance the protection of the law against the strong public interest that innovation continue. This is especially true when a new technology enables a vastly superior mode of distribution, and this P2P has done. P2P technologies can be ideally efficient in moving content across a widely diverse network. Left to develop, they could make the network vastly more efficient. Yet these potential public benefits, as John Schwartz writes in the New York Times, could be delayed in the P2P fight, footnote 26. Yet when anyone begins to talk about balance, the copyright warriors raise a different argument. All this hand-waving about balance and incentives, they say, misses a fundamental point. Our content, the warriors insist, is our property. Why should we wait for Congress to rebalance our property rights? Do you have to wait before calling the police when your car has been stolen? And why should Congress deliberate at all about the merits of this theft? Do you ask whether the car thief had a good use for the car before we arrest him? It's our property, the warriors insist, and it should be protected just as any other property is protected. And that's the end of the chapter on piracy. And now the footnotes, if you give me a moment to get to the right chapter or chapters. Chapter 4, Pirates, Footnotes. Footnote 1. I am grateful to Peter DeMauro for pointing me to this extraordinary history. See also Siva Vaidyanathan, excuse me for massacring your name, Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, 87-93, which details Edison's adventures with copyright and patent. Footnote 2. J.A. Aberdeen, Hollywood Renegades, the Society of Independent Motion Picture Producers, Cobblestone Entertainment, 2000. An expanded text posted at The Edison Movie Monopoly, the Motion Picture Patents Company versus the Independent Outlaws, available at link number 11. For a discussion of the economic motive behind both these limits and the limits imposed by Victor on phonographs, see Randall C. Picker, From Edison to the Broadcast Flag, Mechanisms of Consent and Refusal and the Propertization of Copyright, September 2002, University of Chicago Law School, James M. Olin, Program in Law and Economics, Working Paper Number 159. Footnote 3. Mark Wanamaker, The First Studios, The Silence Majority, archived at link number 12. Footnote 4. to amend and consolidate the Act respecting copyright hearings on S6330 and H.R. 19853 before the Joint Committee on Patents, 59th Congress, 5-9, First Session, 1906. Statement of Senator Alfred B. Kittredge of South Dakota, Chairman. Reprinted in Legislative History of the 1909 Copyright Act, E. Fulton Berlowski and Abe Goldman, Editors, South Hackensack, New Jersey, Rothman Reprints, 1976. Footnote 5. To amend and consolidate the Acts respecting copyright, 223, Statement of Nathan Birkin, Attorney for the Music Publishers Association. Footnote 6. To amend and consolidate the Acts respecting copyright, 226, Statement of Nathan Birkin, Attorney for the Music Publishers Association. Footnote 7. To amend and consolidate the Acts respecting copyright, 23, Statement of John Philip Sousa, Composer. Footnote 8. To amend and consolidate the Acts respecting copyright, 283-84, Statement of Albert Walker, Representative of the Auto Music Perforating Company of New York. Footnote 9. To amend and consolidate the Act respecting copyright, 376. Prepared Memorandum of Philip Mauro, General Patent Counsel of the American Graphophone Company Association. Footnote 10. Copyright Law Revision Hearings on S2499, S2900, H.R. 243, and H.R. 11794 before the Joint Committee on Patents, 60th Congress, First Session, 217, 1908. Statement of Senator Reed Smoot, Chairman, reprinted in Legislative History of the 1909 Copyright Act, E. Fulton Berlowski and Abe Goldman, Editors, South Hackensack, New Jersey, Rothman Reprints, 1976. Footnote 11. Copyright Law Revision Report to accompany H.R. 2512, House Committee on the Judiciary, 90th Congress, First Session, House Document Number 83, 66, 8 March 1967. I am grateful to Glenn Brown for drawing my attention to this report. Footnote 12, see 17 United States Code, Sections 106 and 110. At the beginning, record companies printed, quote, not licensed for radio broadcast, unquote, and other messages purporting to restrict the ability to play a record on a radio station. Judge Learned Hand rejected the argument that a warning attached to a record might restrict the rights of the radio station. See RCA Manufacturing Company versus Whiteman, 114 F. 2nd, 86, 2nd Circuit, 1940. See also Randall C. Picker, From Edison to the Broadcast Flag, Mechanisms of Consent and Refusal and the Propertization of Copyright, University of Chicago Law Review, 70, 2003, 281. Footnote 13. Copyright Law Revision, CATV, hearing on S-1006 before the Subcommittee on Patents, Trademarks, and Copyrights of the Senate Committee on the Judiciary, 89th Congress, 2nd Session, 78, 1966, Statement of Rosell H. Hyde, Chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. Footnote 14. Copyright Law Revision, CATV 116, Statement of Douglas A. Anello, General Counsel of the National Association of Broadcasters. Footnote 15. Copyright Law Revision, CATV 126, Statement of Ernest W. Jennings, General Counsel of the Association of Maximum Service Telecasters, Inc. Footnote 16. Copyright Law Revision, CATV 169, Joint Statement of Arthur B. Krim, President of the United Artists Corp., and John Sin, President of United Artists Television, Inc. Footnote 17. Copyright Law Revision, CATV 209, Statement of Charlton Heston, President of the Screen Actors Guild. Footnote 18. Copyright Law Revision, CATV 216, Statement of Edwin M. Zimmerman, Acting Assistant Attorney General. Footnote 19. See, for example, National Music Publishers Association, The Engine of Free Expression, Copyright on the Internet, The Myth of Free Information, available at link number 13. Quote, the threat of piracy, the use of someone else's creative work without permission or compensation, has grown with the internet, close quote. And that's the end of the footnotes for chapter 4. Here are the footnotes for chapter 5. Footnote 1. See IFPI, International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, the Recording Industry Commercial Piracy Report 2003, July 2003, available at link number 14. See also Ben Hunt, Companies Warned on Music Piracy Risk, Financial Times, 14 February 2003, page 11. Footnote 2. See Peter Drejos with John Brathwaite, Information Feudalism, Who Owns the Knowledge Economy? New York, The New Press, 2003, pages 10 through 13 and 209. The trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, TRIPS agreement, obligates member nations to create administrative and enforcement mechanisms for intellectual property rights, a costly proposition for developing nations. Additionally, patent rights may lead to higher prices for staple industries such as agriculture. Critics of TRIPS question the disparity between burdens imposed upon developing countries and benefits conferred to industrialized nations. TRIPS does permit governments to use patents for public non-commercial uses without first obtaining the patent holder's permission. Developing nations may be able to use this to gain the benefits of foreign patents at a lower price. This is a promising strategy for developing nations within the TRIPS framework. Footnote 3. For analysis of the economic impact of copying technology, see Stan Liebowitz, Rethinking the Network Economy, New York Amicom 2002, pages 144 to 90. Quote, in some instances, the impact of piracy on the copyright holder's ability to appropriate the value of the work will be negligible. One obvious instance is the case where the individual engaging in pirating would not have purchased an original even if pirating were not an option. Ibid, page 149. Footnote 4. Bach versus Longman, 98 English REP period, whatever that stands for, 1274, 1777. How intriguing. Footnote 5. See Clayton M. Christensen, The Innovator's Dilemma, the revolutionary national bestseller that changed the way we do business. New York, Harper Business 2000. Professor Christensen examines why companies that give rise to and dominate a product area are frequently unable to come up with the most creative, paradigm-shifting uses for their own products. This job usually falls to outside innovators who reassemble, existing technology in inventive ways. For a discussion of Christensen's ideas, see Lawrence Lessig, Future, 89-92 and 139. Footnote 6. Carolyn Lockheed, Silicon Valley Dream, Hollywood Nightmare, San Francisco Chronicle, 24 September 2002, A1. Rock and Roll Suicide, New Scientist, 6 July 2002, page 42. Benny Evangelista, Napster Named CEO, Secures New Financing, San Francisco Chronicle, 23 May 2003, C1. Napster's Wake Up Call, Economist, 24 June 2000, page 23. And John Naughton, Hollywood at War with the Internet, London Times, 26 July 2002, page 18. Footnote 7. See Ipsos Insight, Tempo, Keeping Pace with Online Music Distribution, September 2002, reporting that 28% of Americans aged 12 and older have downloaded music off of the Internet, and 30% have listened to digital music files stored on their computers. Footnote 8. Amy Harmon, Industry Offers a Carrot in Online Music Fight, New York Times, 6 June 2003, A1. Footnote 9. See Liebowitz, Rethinking the Network Economy, pages 148 to 149. Footnote 10. See Capgemini Ernst & Young, Technology Evolution in the Music Industry's Business Model Crisis, 2003, page 3. This report describes the music industry's efforts to stigmatize the budding practice of cassette taping in the 1970s, including an advertising campaign featuring a cassette-shaped skull and the caption, "Home taping is killing music." At the time digital audio tape became a threat, the Office of Technical Assessment conducted a survey of consumer behavior. In 1988, 40% of consumers older than 10 had tape music to a cassette format. U.S. Congress, Office of Technology Assessment, Copyright and Home Copying, Technology Challenges the Law, OTA CIT 422, Washington, D.C., U.S. Government Printing Office, October 1989, pages 145 to 156. Footnote 11, U.S. Congress, Copyright and Home Copying, page 4. Footnote 12, see Recording Industry Association of America, 2002 year-end statistics, available at link 15. A later report indicates even greater losses. See Recording Industry Association of America, Some Facts About Music Piracy, 25 June 2003, available at link 16. Quote, in the past 4 years, unit shipments of recorded music have fallen by 26%, from 1.16 billion units in 1999 to 860 million units in 2002 in the United States, based on units shipped. In terms of sales, revenues are down 14%, from 14.6 billion in 1999 to 12.6 billion last year, based on US dollar value of shipments. The music industry worldwide has gone from a $39 billion industry in 2000 down to a $32 billion industry in 2002, based on U.S. dollar value of shipments. Footnote 13, Jane Black, Big Music's Broken Record, Business Week Online, 13 February 2003, available at link number 17, 14 IBID. Footnote 15, by one estimate, 75% of the music released by the major labels is no longer in print. 75%? See Online Entertainment and Copyright Law, coming soon to a digital device near you. Hearing before the Senate Committee on the Judiciary, 107th Congress, First Session, 3 April 2001, Prepared Statement of the Future of Music Coalition, available at link 18. Footnote 16. While there are not good estimates of the number of used record stores in existence, in 2002 there were 7,198 used book dealers in the United States, an increase of 20% since 1993. See Book Hunter Press, The Quiet Revolution, The Expansion of the Used Book Market, 2002, available at link number 19. Used records accounted for $260 million in sales in 2002. See National Association of Recording Merchandisers, 2002 Annual Survey Results, available at link number 20. Footnote 17. See Transcript of Proceedings in Re Napster Copyright Litigation at 34-35, ND Cal 11 July 2001. Numbers MDL 001369 MHP, C99-5183 MHP, available at link 21. For an account of the litigation and its toll on Napster, see Joseph Menn, All the Rave, The Rise and Fall of Sean Fanning's Napster, New York Crown Business, 2003, pages 269 to 282. Footnote 18, copyright infringements, audio and video recorders, hearing on S. 1758 before the Senate Committee on the Judiciary, 97th Congress, First and Second Sessions, 459, 1982, testimony of Jack Valenti, President, Motion Picture Association of America, Inc. Footnote 19, copyright infringements, audio and video recorders, page 475. Footnote 20, Universal City Studios, Inc. versus Sony Corp. of America, 480 F. Sup. 429 and 438, CD Cal 1979. Footnote 21, copyright infringements, audio and video recorders, 485, testimony of Jack Valenti. Footnote 22, Universal City Studios, Inc. versus Sony Corp. of America, 659 F. 2nd, 963 9th Circuit, 1981. Footnote 23, Sony Corp. of America versus Universal City Studios, Inc., 464 U.S., 417, 431, 1984. Footnote 24. These are the most important instances in our history, but there are other cases as well. The technology of digital audio tape, DAT for example, was regulated by Congress to minimize the risk of piracy. The remedy Congress imposed did burden DAT producers by taxing tape sales and controlling the technology of DAT. See Audio Home Recording Act of 1992, Title 17 of the United States Code, Pub L number 102-563, 106 Stat 4237, codified at 17 U.S.C. Section 1001. Again, however, this regulation did not eliminate the opportunity for free riding in the sense I've described. See Lessig Future, page 71. See also Picker, From Edison to the Broadcast Flag, University of Chicago Law Review, 70, 2003, pages 293-96. Footnote 25. Sony Corp. of America versus Universal City Studios, Inc., 464 U.S. 417, 432, 1984. And finally, footnote 26, John Schwartz, New Economy, The Attack on Peer-to-Peer Software, Echoes Past Efforts, New York Times, 22, September 2003, C3. And that's the end of the footnotes for Chapter 5. And that's the end of this recording as well. I hope you enjoyed it.